Hello.
Hey, we have some early birds. This is Dave, who's present.
Hi, Dave. This is Nancy. I wanted to be extra early because I'm your facilitator.
Thank you very much, Nancy. I appreciate it. I had word that you were doing this. And how can I be of help to you?
I think we're set. I'm not going to give your entire introduction, a very abbreviated litany of all of your success, if that's okay with you.
We can save time, and I can move right into it. In fact, I mentioned to Heather.
Hi, guys. It's Heather. I'm here.
Heather, hey.
Hey.
I mentioned when we did the workshop in Boston, you know, here's a simple way to introduce me. You can just say, you know, Dave is, you know, a husband, a dad, and a granddad, and if he's good, the rest will take care of itself. So here he is. Actually, one person, a buddy of mine, when I did a workshop for her for an entire day, I said that, and she did that. And I was like, oh, my God, I really got to live into this.
That's right. Well, we'll
it.
Set the stage with a couple more things to establish your credibility, Dave. But I would say those are the hallmarks of a good man, to be able to say those are your best accomplishments.
Okay.
Yeah. Truly.
I think we're also going to suggest that people can stay on for 10 extra minutes. Do you guys think that I should give the final code and everything before we go into those 10 extra minutes?
I do, for people that have not planned for that.
Okay, so at the top of the hour, I will give the code, and then, Dave, you're willing to stay on for 10 more minutes, right?
Yeah, and I think it'll be good to announce it in the beginning. I mean,
I totally
abbreviate anything you say to me, but I would say we're going to do 10 extra minutes because there's been a request for more conversation and discussion. So if you can stay, if not, it'll be recorded and you can do a playback and you can always do a fast forward on the recording. If you do it online or if you do it MP3 download, you can also do a fast forward.
Oh, that's true too. You can get your code if you listen to the recording.
Yeah,
they can tune back on to listen to the questions, you know, that are asked after the hour.
Mm-hmm, right. Well, at the top of the hour, I'll just give a little closure and give the code and then say, well, that you're available for a few more minutes. So we'll
get and then, Nancy, if you can timekeep that would be great.
Okay.
Yep, I will definitely do that.
And what about the middle section, Dave? How long do you want to take?
We're going to do a halftime. I don't have a show, but we're going to do a halftime.
Yeah.
And that obviously is a popular request, so we can do clarifications or brief questions for a few minutes to not have to wait the entire time.
Okay.
So I'll announce that, too, at the beginning.
Yes, perfect.
I'll announce that, too, at the beginning, Dave, and then you can just manage it.
Right.
So I think other people are joining us now.
And you might also mention, I see on their computers video, if they step away and get a beer, they need to stay and pay attention. So otherwise,
no. Unless they send you one, too.
Yeah, you're right.
Well, we don't want to
scare
them.
Regular halftime stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Even though you guys are in New England.
Yeah, oh, I know. Yeah. Nancy, what time do you have?
I have 2 minutes still.
Okay, Chris. Thank you.
Dave, it's so good of you to be with us. We surely appreciate it.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
I mean, I fell in love with the group when I did in the spring the workshop, and I'm really happy to do this, and it's been an amazing group with energy and input and interaction. It's a very lively group, so it's a real privilege.
Yep. I feel like I'm counting down to get my Southwest seats or something.
Yeah, totally.
Since I'm too cheap to buy the
the extra, by the upgrade.
Right.
I want to emphasize to anyone who's listening who's already signed on, if there are questions or comments that you have, feel free to send them to me in an email, and I will launch the next seminar with responses. I've gotten a couple. My direct email is dkruger, D-K-R-U-E-G-E-R, at mentorpath.com, M-E-N-T-O-R-P-A-T-H.com. And feel free to send me any comments or questions or things that you'd like me to touch on in a following seminar, and I'll be happy to address it.
Okay, Dave, we're ready to go.
Okay.
Welcome to our ICF New England teleseminar, Massive Success Strategies, How to Use Influence, Psychology, Persuasion Science, and Neuromarketing to Enhance Your Business. I'm Nancy Formella. I serve as the secretary of our organization. I'm also a member of our Education and Professional Development Committee, and I'm very happy to be your facilitator tonight. We have some new people joining us on this second call, and I want to be sure and welcome them as well. Last time we reviewed the psychology of influence, and tonight we will discuss the neuroscience of persuasion. Discussion is being recorded, and we remind you to please mute your telephones unless you are presenting tonight or are invited by our presenter to participate. You can mute and unmute your phone by pressing *6. In the email you received from ICF New England with the session details, you also have a link there to the class page that gives you the class outline, a free ebook offered exclusively to participants, and a place for the core class recording. We're delighted that you're all here with us tonight. And something new, Dr. Kruger will be taking a break midway. He calls it his halftime show to check in with you and see what questions you have. Dave will also stay on the line for an additional 10 minutes after the end of our session for more questions, but I will close us right at the top of the hour so you can get your CEU code. Dave just was telling us that we may also email him after the session. I'm sure he can tell us his email address very quickly when he starts. As a reminder, somebody doesn't have their phone on mute. Everybody check your phone to put it on mute, please. As a reminder to set the stage.
Please manage the background noise so that we can keep an open line for discussion beginning.
I just want to tell you two things about Dave. He's an executive mentor coach. He's CEO of MentorPath. He's an executive coach, which is an executive coaching, training, publishing, and wellness firm. His work integrates psychology and neuroscience with strategic coaching to help executives and professionals write the next chapter of their lives or business stories. He's extremely well-published, and he has spoken extensively. We're thrilled to welcome him back to ICFNE. So, Dave, thank you for being here.
Thanks very much. I appreciate that, Nancy. And I want to emphasize again to manage the background noise. I think someone has walked away from the phone, but anything that you do, even breathing, is picked up. So if you shuffle papers or move about, anything is picked up by your microphone and you don't hear it. So I want to keep an open line in the beginning and at our halftime and again at the end. And I'm going to stay 10 minutes past the top of the hour for those of you who would like to have or discuss the questions that we did not cover. So again, manage your noise. If you're not ready to say something, stay on *6 because even movement is picked up. So it'll preserve the quality because we have a lot of people. So your thoughts and questions, any feedback, questions, things from last time that we didn't cover or didn't get to in our discussion. Let me begin. Let me prime the pump here then and begin with a question that was sent in. And I welcome you to to send any questions or thoughts or feedback to me directly, dkruger@mentorpath.com, dkruger@mentorpath.com, for anything that we don't get to or things that weren't quite clear. I'll be happy to put that in the queue for discussion for next time. One question had to do with how does proven evidence change beliefs? So I want to give you the answer and then tell you. Proven evidence does not change beliefs. So the reason is facts and beliefs are anatomical realities in our brains. So we don't create a change by suddenly introducing a new idea and expect it to overwrite the one that's already there. Facts and logic are not powerful tools to alter opinions. Data is not a way to change minds. It's simply not how we decide. In fact, established beliefs are really extremely resistant to change, even when there's ample evidence, scientific evidence, that disproves those beliefs. People regard data as valid evidence only when it reinforces their existing views. This is what we know now, and this is why it's important to keep this in mind when you're presenting anything about your services or your products or making your recommendations. And this is how arguments are more staunchly solidified with existing data that proves what somebody already believes. It's called the boomerang effect. Presenting someone with information that contradicts an opinion they already have causes them to generate new counterarguments to further strengthen their view. So this boomerang effect says that people grow more confident in their initial convictions. So actually people use information to polarize opinions, like on abortion or homosexuality or climate change. So what can we do then to change beliefs? Well, one way to think about it is new information is really evaluated relative to pre-established beliefs. So the further away any new information is from the established beliefs, the more likely it is to be considered invalid. So remember when we talked last time about your first challenge is to resonate with your client's challenge or your customer's challenge. How do you get inside that circle? You drew a stick figure in a circle. That's your client. How do you get inside that circle? It's to resonate with the challenge and the issues that that person is experiencing. Then you can go someplace new. So you identify existing beliefs, common motivations, common goal. And remember, a fast way to transmit something from one brain to another is emotion. Brains synchronize when emotion becomes a common ground. And how can you best establish emotion? Story. Emotion can be established quickly through the creation of story. We resonate and impact each other by way of emotion, share feelings and ideas in a story. So that's why I emphasized so much last time to think about you, what you do, your brand, your coaching firm, as a story, and to be able to tell that story in a very succinct and compelling way. So I hope that answered the comment that I got. Now, I'm interested in other thoughts or ideas or questions that you have before we move into our discussion today on the neuroscience of persuasion. What else? Other thoughts or comments or questions? One thing you want to remember in coaching is that each of your clients do not experience their story as a story, but as just the way things are. Story is a metaphor that we have to understand and be able to put together what we're hearing from the client. I don't know if any of you are watching the series or have watched Alias Grace or read Mark Atwood's book, Alias Grace. She has a terrific quotation that really says this so succinctly. She said, when you're in the middle of a story, it isn't a story at all, but only a confusion, a dark roaring, a blindness, a wreckage of shattered glass and splintered wood. So remember that story is our metaphor, not necessarily our clients, but it's a powerful way to really understand and to listen from the client's perspective of what they experience. Thoughts, questions, clarifications?
Dave?
Yes.
Can you clarify, please? Last time you talked about defining your story and you used the metaphor of the elephant and the rider. Can you just give a quick summation of what that was?
Yeah, you look at an elephant and a rider, and it looks like the rider's in charge because he's up there directing. But really, wherever the elephant decides to go is where things are going to proceed. The elephant is the emotional brain. The rider is the intellectual brain. And the way we make decisions is emotionally. The emotional decision-making process is way faster than the intellectual. We know from neuroeconomics labs, as I mentioned last time, that we make purchase decisions up to 10 seconds before we're even consciously aware of them. And in fact, some neuroscientists now take the position that the primary purpose of the left forebrain is to make sense of and make conscious what we've already decided at an emotional level. So this is why we want to be aware of appealing to both the emotional and the aspect and the intellectual aspects. This is why proven evidence doesn't change beliefs, because that's not how we decide. That's what the discussion I just went through was addressing from another perspective, that information is not what changes minds. And information is not your unique advantage. People can get all kind of information on the internet. So engaging in a meaningful discussion and story that begins where the client is, that's a beginning. That's the entering that circle. Now, does that make sense to you?
Very helpful. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. Anything else? Questions, thoughts? Okay, well, I'm going to move us then to lecture mode and, again, jot down any comments or questions, and we'll come to those at our halftime. I haven't decided exactly where that's going to be, but I'll sort of play that by ear. Okay, from your outline, I'd like you to look at the quiz under Seminar 2. Ohio State University studied several hundred undergraduates and asked them to rate how much they wanted and liked various pleasurable activities. What do you think was number one? Ohio State University undergraduates. Receiving a paycheck? Seeing a best friend? Engaging in sexual activity? Receiving a compliment or getting a good grade? Or eating a favorite food? Now, a hint, one of these was endorsed as much as the other four combined. So we'll come back to that after it sort of marinates, okay? Persuasion is simply an active process of choice architecture to get a prospect to clearly associate a desired feeling and outcome with your product or service. The most significant thing that great persuaders understand and communicate, it's not about you, it's about them. And remember your primary question. What is it you want to accomplish through this? When President Abraham Lincoln was a successful lawyer prior to his presidency, he began presenting a case by establishing a positive frame for him and his clients that created a distinct advantage. This is what he did. He would begin his opening arguments by summing up the other side's case. He would point out the positive aspects of their position, how worthy of consideration they were, and establish credibility by demonstrating that he recognized the other side had a legitimate view. That was unheard of. He presented his client's side in detail. people then listened carefully because his credibility was high. The judge and jury both concluded that if he's so willing to give credibility to the viewpoint of the other side, he must be honest in speaking from his heart. This frame of respect and understanding of the other person's point of view establishes a common ground, a connection before presenting your position. So, let's look at a fundamental aspect of persuasion science. Our aversion to loss is hardwired. We learn more quickly from pain than from pleasure because negative stimuli get more attention and response. Avoiding loss has, in an evolutionary sense, kept us alive. Now, Daniel Kahneman won a Nobel Prize by demonstrating that notions of loss are more powerful than focus on gain. He demonstrated we register twice as much pain from losing $100 than the pleasure of gaining $100, loss aversion. This means that people are more emotionally concerned with not making a bad decision than with making the best decision. So, from psychology and social neuroscience, we know the twin forces of motivation that drive all human behavior. These are foundational: the desire to avoid pain and the desire to seek pleasure. These two twin forces, these organizing principles of brain wiring to minimize danger or pain and to maximize reward or pleasure, are overarching. If we associate positive emotions or reward, we approach. If we associate negative emotions or pain, we avoid. Now, here's one meaning. If someone buys, they associate more pleasure to buying than not buying. If someone doesn't buy, they associate more pain to buying than not buying. As we process the pleasure and pain cues unconsciously, we do that in 1/5 of a second. That's how we make decisions at a midbrain level. So here's a master formula for persuasion. To associate buying with getting pleasure and the benefit, and not buying with pain. Greater gain with action, loss with failure to act. Since people do more, we all do more to avoid pain than to seek pleasure. Both avoiding pain and inertia, remaining in the status quo, are two innate brain tendencies to be aware of. Short term equals pain. Giving up money, for example. Most people need to think long term to be successful. Think about how much we each do to prevent pain. Pay bills, do taxes, exercise, maintain your house or car. Our brains are hardwired to prevent pain, to prioritize survival over improvement. You're not selling survival. You're not selling the ways and means of survival. You're selling growth and enhancement, actualization of professional and personal aspects of life and business. This means that our brains are primarily a mechanism for survival rather than designed for success, fulfillment, and growth. So here's the challenge then. So let's apply this pain-pleasure brain formula to the three-story components that we talked about last time. The challenge: find the need or interest that's not fulfilled, what your prospects want but are not getting. The mid portion of a story, the development: show how to meet the challenge. And the resolution: clarify the emotional and logical reasons to act and tell them specifically what to do or how to act or make your recommendation. Very clear and confident and brief. People want emotionally but justify logically. So find emotional motivators to have or be the best for their clients, to have the best relationship or skill set, to be fully informed, to be confident. Since part of persuasion focuses on avoiding pain, if you focus on price, especially early on, this adds to their pain rather than alleviating. That's not something you want to lead with. It's something you want to wrap into a recommendation because it's a component of an action step. We keep things to avoid the regret we would experience in giving them up. That includes our money. Participants in a research study were given a lottery ticket, then asked if they would trade the ticket for a different one with an equal chance of winning. Significantly less than half agreed to do that, even when they were bribed by chocolate. Sounds like a study I would set up. When the experiment was repeated with pins instead of lottery tickets, 90% of participants agreed to trade. Now, what's the difference? Well, pins are tangible and real. Lottery tickets are a story of hope. Dopamine for a dollar. People hang on to lottery tickets to hope for the best and to avoid the regret they would experience if they had switched and their original ticket won. So, let's apply that. From a marketing perspective, giving somebody $100 to be applied toward a future purchase is a greater incentive than a $100 discount. Consumer psychology tells us that people will gravitate toward purchasing decisions that do one or more of these things: reduce the fear of making a mistake, make them feel more in control, simplify the decision process, offer simple, clear, immediate emotional benefits, and eliminate obstacles. Make it clear, specific, and simple. So, now let's apply that to talk about the six principles of persuasion. Persuasion appeals to deeply rooted human responses of mind or brain. Strategies that simply inform people about facts and reasons to make changes have a high likelihood of failure. That's basically what I said at the top of the hour in response to the question that was sent in. Information does not lead people to make decisions. It's not how we make decisions. If information would change behavior, you've heard this somewhere before, and it was about a week ago. If information would change behavior, we'd all be thin. We'd work out every day, we'd eat mostly vegetables, we'd have significant money saved, and a bunch of librarians would be billionaires. The mind and brain scientists can tremendously inform persuasion to determine decisions and results. How information is communicated, how we communicate information, can dramatically affect how it's perceived and how it's acted on. So, the first principle, these six principles of persuasion, are, I think, really significant and have each has numerous neuroscience studies that validate it. I'm just going to give you a highlight in an application. The first principle of persuasion is liking. Now, this is in your outline, so highlight that. We like people who like us, who are similar to us in some way. We buy from people we like. We prefer to say yes to people we know, like, and trust. The application here, and I'm going to do an application for each of these six principles. Find something in common. Discover real similarities, genuine connection, and offer authentic comments. Here's a scientific case study. When I was about 8 years old, it was time to buy a new coat for school. I went to the big city close to the little town, population 720, where I lived outside that town on a farm. We looked at coats at three stores, because that's all there were: Penny's, Sears, and Monkey Ward's. Don't even ask, because that's all there was. At one store, I really liked the salesman. He was warm, engaging, funny, seemed to take a genuine interest in me. The coat I was looking at there was light blue, soft velour with an elastic bottom, sort of a balloon effect. You pretty much had to be there. He said, "Man, you look really good in that coat." Nobody had ever told me I looked good in a coat before. I knew right then that was the coat I was going to buy. I just had to convince my mom. I emphasized to my mom how much I wanted that coat. Now, I didn't particularly like the coat, but I really liked that salesman. I liked the coat even less when I got home. The salesman had done a splendid job. I couldn't grow out of that coat fast enough. For 3 years, every time it got cold, I had vague memories of a very nice salesman while I looked like my head was on top of a light blue marshmallow. So, this is how not to do it, okay? Here's an application I'm calling the Magic Johnson Principle. When my son and daughter began playing basketball in grade school, and I was coaching their teams, we had season tickets to the Houston Rockets. Two seats, and they would each do a draft between them at the beginning of the season to pick who went to what game, and we'd have dinner before the game. When the Lakers were in town, they were each excited when their turn came to see Magic Johnson. Before the game began, I gave them each a quiz. Notice how he plays and see what you can pick up about what his strategy is, especially how he relates to everybody on the court. And after the game, I ask each what they noticed and not to tell the other about the answer. No trouble with that. They each mentioned how Magic seemed to be great friends with everybody on the court, including the opposing team members. What else, I asked. And the referees. And I nudged. Anything else? They each mentioned some aspect of how much he actually fouled, but he hardly ever seemed to be called for the fouls. Exactly. Everybody on the court likes him. All the players on both sides and the referees especially liked him. And he genuinely seemed to like them. He was as expert at handling relationships as he was the ball. And they hardly ever called a foul on him. They participated in his success and in that mindset of the good feeling. They would be less likely to feel that participation in success if they had to call a foul and disrupt the flow of that state of good energy experience with him. In his entire NBA career, Magic only fouled out of 5 games. That is unprecedented. When people like you and sense you have something in common, they're more likely to say yes. It's the law of attraction in action. People essentially do business with and refer business to those who they like, know, and trust. People commit not to things, but to people who they believe care about them. So, a question. What are the factors that cause one person to like another person? And they're not all visible. 4 of the most common. The halo effect. A halo effect occurs when one positive characteristic of a person dominates the way that person is viewed by others. Examples are kindness, honesty, intelligence. We are always teaching people how to respond to us. Another similarity. We like people who are similar to us. Similar backgrounds, interests, age, religion, politics. Roger Dooley, author of the book Brainfluence, talked about this when he was the expert content contributor at my mastermind group and illustrated it by pointing out how I used something I knew we had personally in common in my introduction of him. Compliment. The greatest car salesman in the world, Joe Girard, said that the secret of success was mutually liking clients. Each month, he sent every one of his more than 13,000 former clients a greeting card and a personal message, and the message never varied. It always included, "I like you." And people who knew him said he authentically meant it, and he kept up with each of those people. And fourthly, contact and cooperation. Things that are familiar to us are most likely to persuade. By providing people with different backgrounds with more exposure to one another as equals, they come to like each other better. Mr. Rogers carried in his wallet a statement that said, "Frankly, there isn't anyone you couldn't learn to love once you've heard their story." We are wired to socially connect with others. A study in Edinburgh planted hundreds of wallets on city streets. The wallets contained one of 4 possible photos: a smiling baby, a cute puppy, a happy family, an elderly couple. And a 5th group of wallets had no photo at all. The percentage of wallets that were returned: with the baby photo, 88%. With the puppy photo, 53%. With the family photo, 48%. With the elderly couple, 28%. Those with no photo, barely double digits, 14%. Now, the second principle of persuasion is reciprocity. This is important. Keep this in mind. We repay in kind. People return favors. When we help people, they'll want to help us. This induces oxytocin, the brain chemical of connection and bonding. The application here? Give what you want to receive. Your income is determined by how many people you serve and how well you serve them. When we behave in a certain way, such as cooperatively, someone responds in kind. We try to repay in kind what another person has provided us. It provides a sense of connection and closure. We have serious persuasive power immediately after someone thanks us. Well, of course, that's what partners do for each other. In a number of studies, reciprocity is so strong that it overwhelmed other factors. In one study, success in selling raffle tickets was most effective for subjects who first received a Coke. The feeling of wanting to reciprocate to the giver, resulting in buying twice as many tickets as those who had not been given the prior favor. Think of the address labels you get as a gift with a request for donation. In one study, shoppers at a candy store made 42% more purchases when they received a gift piece of chocolate when they walked in the store. When reciprocity is meaningful and unexpected, the size of the tips that food servers receive is impacted. To diners offered a piece of chocolate at the end of their meals by the waitress, tips increased 3.3%. To diners invited to take two chocolates from the basket, tips increased 14.1%. Now, in another scenario, after offering guests one chocolate from the basket, turning away, and unexpectedly returning to the table to offer a second chocolate, tips increased by 21.3%. The third principle of persuasion, social proof. We follow the lead of similar others, especially in ambiguous situations, and when we're uncertain, we do things we see other people doing, and more so if those people seem similar to us. So the application here, provide a context to guide or demonstrate adaptive behavior. Social proof is a way we determine basically what is correct, popular, or acceptable. We find out what other people think about it, especially in ambiguous situations where we're not sure. We even view behavior as more correct in a given situation if we see others performing it. In one study of donations to a street musician in Washington, D.C., researchers set two situations to observe the rate of donation to the musician. Then, at another match time, whenever someone was approaching the musician, one of the members of the study would drop some money in the hat of the street musician so the approaching subject would see it. Viewing this act increased donation 8 times. In follow-up, not a single one of the people acknowledged being influenced by seeing the other people donate money on their actions. Instead, they came up with various rational reasons, such as liking the music. So, this means that basing influence strategy on what people acknowledge that influences them can have a high failure rate. People are often not consciously aware of what influences them or what to attribute as the cause. Add specificity. A study in Great Britain found that the most remarkable success of getting people to pay delinquent taxes was the option that indicated the specific number of their fellow citizens living in their zip code who were paying their taxes. Focus on behaviors that are frequently adopted and are desirable. Social proof and other influence factors have to be authentic and ethical. The fourth principle of persuasion. How about we complete the six principles of persuasion and then we'll do a halftime break. So jot down any thoughts or questions you have. The fourth principle of persuasion, commitment and consistency. We have a deeply held motivation to behave consistently with commitments we've made, especially those commitments that are made public to others. The application here, write down and publicly declare a commitment. We're then more likely to follow through. Now, here's a question I'll bet you've already considered. How can you persuade someone to keep an initial appointment with you? A series of experiments were conducted at 3 busy doctor's offices where patients, immediately after being provided with a date and time on a standard appointment-making card, were asked to read back out loud those appointment details before hanging up the phone. This verbal commitment resulted in a significant increase in follow-through. One variation, though, had an even greater effect. It was for the receptionist to simply ask the patient to write down the time and date of the next appointment on the card. The result was an 18% reduction in no-shows in that group. What this does is put it in an output channel, and we're more likely to retain, member, and make use of things when we put it in an output channel. In instances where it's not reasonable for the client to actively participate in this way, it's more productive to get a response, such as an email, to simply check yes to confirm an agreement. This enhances commitment rates. These are all ways to help people take ownership of their own stories to use this output channel. We each have a basic desire to be and appear consistent with what we've already done, especially what we've committed to. Once we make a choice, we justify and rationalize that choice. We gather data to confirm it, a confirmation bias, and selectively omit data that may refute it, inattentional blindness. These internal and external pressures will cause us to respond in ways that justify our earlier decision. We make our beliefs and perceptions consistent with what we've already decided. In other words, this principle of consistency is powerful enough to direct both our perception and our action. A desire for consistency is strong enough to be a central motivator and organizer of our behavior. Both mind and brain incline toward the continuity of no change. Body at rest tends to stay at rest. A body in motion tends to stay in motion. The fifth principle of persuasion, authority. We defer to experts and those in authority. The authority principle is an application of the halo effect. The application? Expose your expertise. Don't assume it's self-evident. When you need someone to advance your case or product or service, having an agent or an advocate can be very helpful. You're perceived as more prestigious if someone is advocating for you. This is the idea behind book blurbs or endorsements from respected authorities or testimonials. When you negotiate with an organization, first develop an internal champion within the organization who can both advocate and provide information. And the sixth principle of persuasion, scarcity. We want more of what we can have less of. People value things more when they perceive them to be scarce. Opportunities and objects seem more valuable to us when their availability is limited. The application, highlight unique benefits and exclusive information. G.K. Chesterton put it very simply, the way to love anything is to realize it might be lost. Here's an application. Caitlin, my granddaughter, in Boston, by the way, who was 4 at the time, was playing with a stuffed bear in her pre-kindergarten class. Sarah, her little buddy, suddenly decided she wanted to play with that bear as well. Now, there were other toys around. There was no bear deficit, but Sarah was no longer satisfied until she had Caitlin's stuffed bear. Caitlin's mother, my daughter Lauren, who many of you met at the workshop that I did there, a clinical psychologist, was rendered as helpless as Caitlin's absent granddad Dave in orchestrating her mastery to maintain possession of that coveted bear, or to work out a compromise for all-or-nothing 4-year-old possession-oriented minds. Caitlin will learn later about how her own desires will be influenced by neuromarketing techniques based on celebrity induction, social valuation, and popular trending stuffed bears, even the induced shortage of specific stuffed bears. But for now, she has only impromptu strategies to wrest her bear from the evil clutches of Sarah's immediate, inspired desire. Now, as all children do, they both had a radar for scarcity, the unequal distribution of wealth, tangible or emotional. Both girls were in the grips of the scarcity principle. When something becomes rare or scarce, it becomes more valuable, enhancing desire. When increasing scarcity interferes with our access to something, we react by wanting to possess it even more. Later in their lives, Caitlin and Sarah will contend with marketing messages that are adult versions of the bear story. Limited number, only two left, one day remaining. We're not making any more of these. Mimetic desire, one person's desire mimicking that of another, is not limited to children, but plays a significant role in product adoption of best-selling goods. Our neural system contributes to this contagion of desire. The more valued the person, the more attention we pay to that mirroring process. The scarcity principle involves a secondary source of persuasion. As opportunities become less available, we lose freedom and choice, so we desire to preserve our established priorities. We need to couple not just what would be gained by acting or purchasing, but also what would be lost if someone does not act or purchase. When increasing scarcity interferes with our access to something, we'll react by trying to possess the item even more. In fact, a related tendency is to want what's been banned and to presume it's more worthwhile when it's limited. Louis Neiser put it very simply, some people will believe anything if you whisper it to them. I want to tell you a brief story to apply this, and then we'll take a brief break before looking at the tools of persuasion to really apply this. Many years ago, after completing my subspecialty training in psychoanalysis, I was invited to join the faculty of the Psychoanalytic Institute. I was even more excited when I was also invited to offer a continuing education course in the evening to the professional community on any subject I chose. I was warned not to be disappointed if the enrollment was low, because the highest subscription for any course that had been offered to date was 7 people. Of course, I asked it. And the average was 4 to 5, and occasionally courses had to be dropped because there wasn't enough registration or there was no registration. So the first thing I did when announcing the course was to stipulate, in order to ensure optimum discussion, a maximum of 12 seats available. Now, I was a natural optimist and didn't know consciously at the time about the scarcity principle. In the first 2 days, 14 people signed up and the waiting list grew. So here's a brief overview of these 6 universal principles of persuasion that apply mind and brain principles. Liking and reciprocity highlight connectedness with others to generate positive association. Shared similarity, being and acting together, creates a sense of unity which activates the hormone of connection, of oxytocin. Social proof and authority both reduce uncertainty. Certainty is one of the basic 6 needs that we have. Consistency and scarcity both motivate action. The most important thing in knowing and applying these persuasion principles is to be authentic, to genuinely have your client's best interest at heart. Remember that all influence factors have to be genuine, trustworthy, and ethical. We're in discussion mode now. If you'll manage the background noise, thoughts or questions or comments about anything we talked about. Or
Dave?
Yes.
Dave, this is Stephanie, and I have a couple of things that came to mind as you were sharing all of this.
Let me ask, if anyone is not talking, would you please mute, because the technology has not gotten to the point that there's a great interface between cell phones and computer phones and the teleconference system. So go ahead, Stephanie. Sorry to interrupt you.
Okay. No worries. So I don't know if that's coming from me or not. No, I don't think so. Okay. What I became aware of as you were talking was the idea of guilt when you were talking about reciprocity. And so where does guilt fit in there?
I'm not clear about how you mean that. What is the guilt?
So you were saying something about, well, you were talking about reciprocity, right? And that we pay in kind, we return favors.
Let me clarify. Who's having the guilt and what is the guilt about?
Well, sometimes when people, you give them something in kind, they're not so motivated to reciprocate except they feel guilty. So I'll give you something real basic.
Okay.
Somebody gives you a birthday present. You don't really have a connection with that person, but you feel guilty, like you need to get them a birthday present when it's their birthday.
Okay. So your question then, if that's guilt, what is your question then?
Well, I'm curious where guilt comes in around reciprocity, and or does it make a difference?
Well, and if you would mute now, and I'm going to answer your question just in case it's you. That may be a factor, but you can't really determine that. The best determinant is that somebody wants to reciprocate because of a feeling of connection. Now, somebody individually may process that as a way of feeling guilty if they don't respond, and that's kind of understandable. But Carl Menninger said, save guilt for real sin. You know, guilt is the transgression of one's sense of right or wrong or one's personal identity. It's not shame, that failing to live up to one's ideal, but it's a sense of wrong or right. So it may induce that, but that's not the intent. If somebody does it for that reason, you can't determine that, but that's not your intent. Your intent is to establish a connection, and it's kind of like beginning a conversation. So it's analogous to saying hi to somebody, and, you know, it is the natural way to induce somebody to say hi instead of trying to make them feel guilty if they don't say hi. But you can't determine that. And what I would focus on is the benefit and the connection and how you can perhaps, if this is a discussion about professional services, how you may be able to benefit them if that's the context of this discussion. So, Stephanie, does that sort of answer your question?
Yes, it does. It does. I was just concerned about where it came in, and you kind of answered that for me, so that's great. And sorry I'm giving feedback, so I'm going to go on mute.
Okay, thanks. Thanks for the question. Other thoughts or questions or comments? Everything I've said could not have made that much sense if there's only one question. So I'm interested in your responses.
Hey, David, this is Susan. I have a question on the commitment and consistency.
Sorry, on the what?
Can you hear me?
I can. Say it again, please. I think I lost you, Susan.
Oh, yes, I can hear you now. I just wonder if you can elaborate examples of more examples about commitment and consistency. You gave an example about giving a check mark on appointment. To me, that sounded more like accountability.
Well, and if you would go on mute again in case that's a cell phone or anybody on the cell phone, please go on mute because we're getting feedback and you may not hear it. Commitment and consistency has to do with putting something in an output channel and especially in making it public. Think about how when you end a coaching session, you end the coaching session by summarizing together, ideally from the client's perspective, how the client puts together the information and the discussion to then move to what they want to commit to do in the next week. And when they make that commitment, that's one of the few things, if any, that I write down. If somebody commits to do, when they commit to do something before we meet again next week, I know I'm going to write down those couple of things, and that's where we're going to begin. So when we get an update at the beginning of the next session, as an accountability partner, I'm going to ask about those couple of things they committed to do, and pretty soon after a session or two, they'll recognize that this is part of the continuity and the consistency that we're going to do a follow-up. And this puts it into an action item. And this is what I would want to move as an application here. I want to move to a commitment. A commitment begins with, I will. And here are the beginnings. of sentences that are not commitment. I need to, I should, I ought to, I'm going to try. You know, if somebody says, I'm going to try to quit drinking, you know they're going to keep drinking. When someone says, I will, that's a commitment. And that's what we do with a client, to collaborate to a specific set of steps that will further their progress. Now, when somebody makes any kind of commitment out loud, they are more likely to follow through, just like studies show, for example, when you read something, if you passively try to receive that, you'll get more benefit, you're more likely to remember it, you're more likely to have it accessible when you write it down, or when you dictate from it, or when you outline it. And that puts it in an output channel. That's necessary for optimum performance. So it moves it from a good idea to a plan. Here's a good idea. You know, I'd like to lose weight. Here's the plan. I will get to 185 pounds by the April running of the Boston Marathon. Here's a good idea. I want to save more money. Here's the plan. I will set up an automatic withdrawal from my checking account of $400 every month to move to my retirement account. That's a plan. That's a commitment. Put that commitment into an active mode, and there's a follow-through with it. And any follow-up to that question?
No, that's clear. Thank you so much.
Okay, absolutely. Any other clarification or question?
Yeah, Dave, I have a question. This is Pam Marshall. This may be a little hard to follow, but I have a question about some clients where I have a lot of these things, like reciprocity. I'm surprising them with things, and they respect me. We get along. We've got great relationships. But for whatever reason, in the past, I haven't had products that really were good for them, but now I do. And so I was thinking about, like, they know that I'm going to be there for them regardless of whether they buy from me. But the bottom line is they won't buy. It's just strange, and I can't really figure out what the problem is.
Well, I think I think you need to ask some questions. Get together a focus group of people, maybe from that group, but maybe people parallel
yep.
as much as possible. Do you watch Bull by any chance?
No. Sorry.
Watch one of those, and you'll get an idea of what creating a parallel universe is to get opinions and get feedback. But
okay.
I don't know the answer to that, but the answer is out there somewhere, and you may need to ask directly. You may need to do some direct inquiries about that, or just simply follow-ups from people and ask for their feedback.
That's a good idea. I think I just haven't been brave enough to do that. And I think the bottom line is you're right, just to get a group of them together and say, all right, you know, what's going on? What do you think? What do you guys want to do? You know, this makes sense for you? What do you think?
With a group of your buddies and pick three or four people who you know will give you feedback. Not from this group necessarily, but your buddies. And buy them lunch and suggest that you'd like to run some things by them and get some feedback from them and do a focus on this question and be ready to present in a brief, succinct way so that they can make an informed decision by becoming for a moment or identifying with one of your potential clients or customers. So
okay.
They can make an informed decision.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, well, thanks. I'm going to go back.
Dave, this is Nancy, your facilitator. Instead of cutting you off at the top of the hour, you've graciously agreed to go a little bit longer. And I thought if anybody needs to drop off, I just want to remind them our session is recorded. They can go to the learning page and listen to the recording. They need to wait until the final session on February 6th to get their survey. But for tonight, the code that they need to know is the word persuasion, all in lowercase. And with that, I'd like to give it back to you. And if people need to drop off at the top of the hour, I understand, but you will go about 10 minutes after, and we really thank you for being here.
Okay, absolutely. And I'm going to go back on lecture mode, and I should be concluding by about the top of the hour. Please, when we come back, stay on mute and manage the background noise. So I'm going to go back on lecture mode for just the last components of the primary tools of persuasion. So here's an application, the four primary tools of persuasion. One, already we've discussed in a way, relatedness and connection. For long-term impact, you must care about people and find a way to communicate that feeling of care and of connection. And this may be a part of a response to Pam to counter-identify, to resonate empathically with those people and see what you feel and think about why they're not purchasing something that you think is something they need and could benefit. Empathy is a listening perspective of resonating with someone else's experience, including feelings, perspective, and ways of constructing meaning. In other words, that person's subjective reality. Our ability to influence and persuade depends not only on our ability to empathically understand another person, but to communicate that understanding. This is always a first step. This is how you get in that circle, to empathically resonate with someone to build a common ground of understanding. Everything else follows. If you're not exactly right, the other person appreciates that you've attempted to understand and will correct you. When you listen empathically and communicate that understanding, the other person feels truly heard. This is the effectiveness. This is the essence of effectiveness, to be understood from the other person's point of view. The experience of connecting with another person releases oxytocin in the brain of both parties, further enhancing affiliation and trust. The more people trust one another, the greater the collaboration and shared information. So, the answer to the persuasion quiz done at Ohio State University is the option that's the generator of self-esteem. The other four are markers. The student's valued boost to their self-esteem, such as receiving good grades or compliments, more than the other four combined. And remember, the other four combined included food and sex. The second tool of persuasion, autonomy. Having control over our environment and the choices we make generates the experience of significance, to feel important, unique, effective. When you understand what people believe and need, then you can show them how your product or service will help them be effective to reach their goals and experience mastery. Remember, it's from their point of view. You've entered that circle and joined them there. The third tool, certainty. The need to be certain that we can avoid pain and achieve pleasure is a basic human need. The brain is a pattern recognition machine that constantly tries to predict the near future. The act of creating a sense of certainty is rewarding. Think about how we repeat patterns, listen to the same music, go back to the places we've been, order the same food. Change generates uncertainty. Even a small amount of uncertainty cues the brain's error detection mechanism, contributing to our sense of resisting change. We can increase certainty. This is what you should be asking. How do I increase certainty? We can increase certainty by making concepts tangible, such as how long a meeting will run, as we heard from our coordinator, Nancy, and explicit, such as the objectives. Much of the field of management addresses increasing a sense of certainty at times of change and transition. Think about this. Whenever two people meet, the person with the greatest amount of confidence will influence the other. Confidence is a state of mind that infers certainty. And as any state of mind, it's contagious. So these first three primary tools of persuasion comprise three of the basic six human needs: connection, autonomy, and certainty. The fourth tool of persuasion is state management. Manage your emotions and states of mind. focus is one of the two most powerful ways we regulate states of mind. And I want to emphasize, even though we're going to talk about this much more in Seminar 3, there is a webinar, I touched on this last time, on the homepage of MentorPath that is about managing states of mind, understanding states of mind. It's about 30 to 35 minutes that I think will be worthwhile if you take a chance to listen to this, homepage of MentorPath.com. We determine someone's focus by the questions we ask. Asking questions is our most powerful tool we have to persuade someone. And the way we ask the question frames the answer. This is what we're going to explore considerably in the next seminar. I want to look, before we stop in this portion and go back to a question and discussion, a final comment about the art and science of explanation. A natural inclination we all have is to point to all the available information and a rationale about why people should pay attention to it. Yet, when a medical doctor prescribes a medication, over 50% of the prescriptions are not filled. Of those that are filled, just over 50% are not taken as prescribed. So, less than one in four people actually follow recommendations by an expert. Strategies that attempt to inform people into a desirable change have a high likelihood of failure, as I've mentioned. It's not information per se that leads people to make decisions. Now, we all, to some degree, have to overcome the curse of knowledge. I especially am besought with this curse. The difficulty we have in imagining what it's like to not know what we know, and even more so for me, the killer pairing is wanting to share all of what we know. One of the most profound challenges is to simplify. Although valuable, the knowledge we bring to the table, especially if we get into a teaching mode, will interfere with our ability to engage in conversation and communicate in a clear, simple, succinct way. These following principles from a number of neuroscience studies will heighten impact and retention. So I want to mention just a couple of things. The four principles of good writing as well as good speaking: clarity, brevity, simplicity, and humanity. When you speak to others, they will only be able to fully process and recall about 10 to 12 words before their retention begins to slip, or before they begin to think about what they're going to have for dinner. So consider the 10-10 principle. A collaborator of mine, Mark Waldman, is a Loyola Marymount Executive MBA faculty. He did research using the 10-10 principle. Hold both fists in front of you. Raise one digit every word you speak. When you run out of fingers and thumbs, you stop speaking. This will quickly train your brain to use 10 words in order to speak with clarity, brevity, and simplicity. His research showed that charged situations, especially like divorce, mediation, negotiation, arbitration, things when people want to get into it and start using a whole lot of words, resolved faster, averaging 20 to 25% of the usual time for resolution when they used this principle, and they reached more satisfying and complete conclusions when they did this as opposed to the usual discussion. He describes this and related aspects in his book, Words Can Change Your Brain. So, other considerations to heighten impact and retention. Don't bury the lead. State in your first sentence what problem you address, then the benefits you bring. Now, think about this 10-10 principle, especially when you ask questions in a coaching conversation. Ask a simple, specific question in 10 words or less and wait. Wait for the client to respond. Listen carefully. Knowledge speaks, wisdom listen. Reduce noise. Include only what's simple and relevant, the essence of what you want to say. For example, if you ask a question, make it clear, specific, succinct, then pause. Don't elaborate, don't expand. Don't stack on another question. Don't make it a multiple choice. And have fun. This is the last and important principle. States of mind are contagious. My favorite grandmother said, if you're not having fun, you're not doing it right. We're in discussion mode now. If you again mute until you're ready to talk. And questions, comments, clarifications. Is this making sense to you, and is this a practical application for the kind of things that you have in mind and are thinking about in terms of your practices, in terms of your business?
Yeah, Dave.
I don't know who to call on, but say your name and blast ahead.
So this is Pam Marshall again. So this is one of the things I wanted to learn from this is, you know, I find that people don't remember what you say a lot of times. Like, it's uncanny how much they forget. So this is going to help with retention by keeping this in, like, 10 to 12 word bursts. Like, how do you get them to remember a greater percentage of what you say?
Okay. You have begun, and you've asked an important question, and remember exactly what you're saying to limit it to 10 to 12 words. Remember to listen so that they will put what they hear into an output channel, and you begin to hear how they hear it, what their issues are, what their concerns are, so you're hearing from them. Because that's
okay.
The purpose of the question, that's the purpose of the conversation, is to hear more from them. And remember what we talked about in the first seminar. People don't remember what you told them. They remember what they tell themselves on the basis of what you told them. They remember their internal conversation more than they remember what you told them. So find out immediately what their internal conversation is by getting them to say it out loud, because that means you're going to have a direct access to the information of what they're acting on or going to act on, and that you can engage a conversation in that to make it more real and to create a conversation about that specifically, rather than just assuming they're going to get what you say, because it's not going to happen that way.
Yeah, I missed the first session. I've got to listen to that again, but that's wonderful, because that's one of the challenges is getting people to hear, and really you have to hear them is what you're saying.
Exactly. You have
to enter that circle.
You enter the circle by resonating with their challenge, and you have to know that, and people are going to remember and specifically recall what they say to themselves based on what you say. Think about any conversation you've had. Think about any meeting you've had. Think about our first seminar or any aspect of this seminar. You probably are going to remember more of what you said to yourself than you'll remember exactly what I said. And what you said to yourself is important, because that's what you downloaded. That's what you will put or have put into an output channel. So that's what's meaningful.
Right. Yep. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. There was someone else who spoke at the same time. Thoughts or questions or comment?
Did you give the answer to the quiz?
Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
It was that receiving a compliment or giving a good grade was more than all the others combined, because it was a basic sense of effectiveness, of mastery. That's our most basic desire that we have as humans, to be effective, to be a cause. I've seen direct infant observational studies, videos of kids as young as 3 months of age who have effectiveness pleasure, who have pleasure at being a cause. This is the basis of why we do what we do. Fast forward throughout adulthood, is to be effective. That's the one thing that they could be effective in doing, is to generate the comment or getting a good grade. They could be effective in doing what they did. Other things, it's hit or miss, but that was a direct being a cause. So this is what's important for someone and important to keep in mind. This is what you do with your clients in coaching. You help them effectively create a new story or a revised story. You help them effectively to download a model of understanding, of proceeding, of self-reflection, of looking at what works and doesn't work, of doing more of what works, and if it doesn't work, do something else. So this is a fundamental human desire. And 25 years of practicing psychiatry and psychoanalysis, every psychological symptom that I saw was based on in an original context of someone trying to be effective and just maybe hanging in or staying with that way of doing it that had to be then unlearned. But in a certain circumstance, they did what they did to be effective, even though it may have been contorted or it may have not worked in the real world. So this is in a simple, up-to-date example here. What you do in your coaching session, you want to work in the real world just like your parenting. You want to work in the real world, what you do with your kids. If it's not going to work in the real world to have a fit and get what they want, you don't want to do that with your kids. If they ignore paying you, then that's not going to work in the real world because it's not going to work for their rent or their mortgage to get to it later. So this is part of you do what you do in coaching that's going to work in the real world. And if it works in coaching, it's going to be effective and adaptive and in the client's best interest. Well, I know we're out of time, even with the additional 10 minutes. If there are...
Thank you.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. If there are...
Yeah, that was my first choice, too.
Okay.
But then I changed.
Okay.
Then I changed it.
Okay. If there are questions or comments or any kind of follow-up, email me, dkruger@mentorpath.com, and I'll begin with that next time. So thanks
Dave,
very much.
Dave,
this
has been a fantastic session. We really appreciate it. And to remind people, probably 24 to 48 hours, this will be... the recording will be on our page, and remember that the code for tonight is the word persuasion. I was asked to spell it, P-E-R-S-U-A-S-I-O-N. We will be together next week again, and then February 6th, and we'll start again at 7 p.m. Eastern. So we just really want to thank you, Dave, and thanks to everyone who attended.
Thanks very much. It's a privilege, and I look forward to picking up with you right here next time. Bye now.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Have a great rest of the week, guys.